Support for The Exchange podcast comes from you, our listeners, and from McLean Middleton, New Hampshire's largest law firm. For over 100 years, they've been committed to their clients, community, and colleagues. Locations in Manchester, Portsmouth, and Concord, New Hampshire, and Woburn and Boston, Massachusetts. Learn more at McLean.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Sarah Gibson, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Today, we're discussing the 2020 primary, including last night's Democratic presidential debate and how voters here are sizing up the candidates, plus how leaders in Manchester are responding to the combined crises of homelessness and addiction there. Later, we'll also get an update on a national lawsuit over opioids and what it could mean for New Hampshire. You can stream us live at nhpr.org, or if you like, you can watch us along with our broadcast on Facebook Live at NHPR Exchange. Joining me in the studio this morning is Josh Rogers, NHPR senior political reporter, and Carol Robidoux, Manchester Inklink publisher. Welcome to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And we're going to start off with last night's debate of the 2020 presidential candidates. With us for this part of the program is Lauren Dzensky. She's a reporter for CNN Politics, where she covers politics and co-writes the newsletter The Point with Chris Saliza. She was here in New Hampshire reporting on the 2016 election. Lauren, thanks for taking the time.
Hey, thank you for having me.
So, Lauren, what was your main takeaway from the debate last night?
Well, I think we really saw the two camps of the Democratic Party. You have the moderates and the progressives. And you really, really saw that, especially on the center of the debate stage. You had Elizabeth Warren, you had Bernie Sanders, and between the two of them was Joe Biden. And for a significant chunk of that first part of the debate, it was the three of them essentially sparring over health care. And it was really this stunning example of where this Democratic primary is right now and talking about, you know, where health care could be and even acknowledging how far we've simply come from the Obama administration and kind of this vetting of these different ideas. And it was also interesting, too, because Amy Klobuchar from Minnesota tried to step in and say that, you know, her ideas are moderate, but that doesn't mean that they aren't bold, which is also kind of getting at this idea that just because Sanders and Warren are progressive and they're kind of embodying this populist aspect of the Democratic Party, you have these more moderates who are just as interested in carrying this firebrand role within the party as well.
Yeah. And so, Lauren, as you just mentioned, the Medicare for All debate and the healthcare debate at large got a ton of airtime last night. Here in New Hampshire, when we talk to voters about their concerns, you know, healthcare is certainly high on the list, but we've also heard a lot about climate change and the environment. That did not get nearly as much time. I'm just curious, why do you think the moderators made that choice of priorities?
Yeah, that's a good question. Nationally, we see healthcare as really one of top issues for voters overall. And I think that since it was a national debate, it kind of spoke to a more national audience. And also, it's one of those issues where there is a lot of differences between the candidates and where they stand. So you can really kind of parse those details more closely on a debate stage. That's not to say that climate change and some of these other issues are super important, that they aren't important. And I think that the fact that there are more debates on the horizon, those issues, I think a lot of Democratic voters will be very, very, very eager to hear those discussed. Since really, especially climate change, I don't know if it was really brought up significantly at all during
Yeah, there's very little mention of it at all. Lauren, there was a fair amount of talk about gun control last night. Beto O'Rourke really sticking by his proposal to buy back assault weapons. In your look at polls and conversations with voters, where do most voters stand on a forced buyback program?
Right. It sounds really harsh when you initially kind of when one is framed as, you know, forced buyback. But that proposal, mandatory gun buybacks, are actually very popular among Democrats. A poll this week from the Washington Post and ABC found that 74% of Democrats support a mandatory gun buyback program for assault weapons.
And now, Josh, I want to get Josh in here, because I'm just curious, how do you think that would land with voters here in New Hampshire? I mean, that's a national poll that Lauren is talking about among Democratic voters. What do you think about here?
Hard to say. New Hampshire is obviously a place that has had and continues to have pretty permissive gun laws. The idea of a government, gun rights advocates would put this, confiscating our weapons, is something that, you know, obviously be fighting words in a general election. I do think that there are plenty Democratic voters who would be comfortable with that. But, you know, typically this has not been something that Democrats have proposed. You think back to the last election, when Hillary Clinton was seeking the nomination here, I covered a town hall meeting she had in Keene where the question of a buyback was raised. And, you know, she talked about a voluntary buyback. And obviously there have been buybacks in other countries where they've had mass shootings. O'Rourke post his failure to get much traction, and also post the mass shootings in his home state of Texas, has really, you know, been quite aggressive on this front. His campaign clearly thinks this is working. At the convention in New Hampshire, the Democratic convention, where all the candidates spoke, I mean, certainly guns came up, and we're in a state where democratically controlled legislature passed gun bills that advocates couch as so-called common sense gun bills, basically closing loopholes in terms of background checks, red flag laws. Those bills have been vetoed by Governor Chris Sununu. The legislature is going to take those up next week. They're not likely to have the votes to override the vetoes. O'Rourke has made a decision, and maybe this is where the party is going. I mean, it's possible that we might get a bigger debate, but, you know, the reality is if without the control of the Senate, their gun bills waiting to be taken up by the U.S. Senate that aren't going to get taken up. So without a big shift, but certainly in terms of, I would agree with Lauren that there are plenty of Democrats who are totally comfortable.
And Carol, you wanted to jump in?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I noted after Beto spoke, Elizabeth Warren jumped in and said something about the overarching problem in our country with gun violence, and that we need to keep working at it and get the conversation started going with all the stakeholders. And I think that was a valid point, that we talk about it when there's a mass shooting, and we get upset about it, and we want to take the big guns off the streets or buy them back. But it is why so much gun violence across the board, and it's an American problem. So
yeah, and Lauren, for listeners who were not staying up very late last night listening to the whole debate, can you talk a little bit about, you know, there are certainly references to the mass shootings of late that unfortunately are becoming so common, but there is also Cory Booker, for instance, talking about gun control in the context of kind of the daily experience of gun violence, particularly in more urban settings, and also some people talking about it in the context of domestic violence throughout the country. And can you just talk a little bit about where some of the other candidates came in with their own personal experiences around gun violence and what that would mean for their policies if they were elected president?
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to get back to the Elizabeth Warren component of that as well. I thought it was striking that when she talked about the gun issue, she emphasized gun violence. And she really, you know, she referenced her brothers who are hunters and use guns for hunting, and kind of has this more nuanced look at gun violence, kind of in a sharp contrast to Beto O'Rourke. Of course, that wasn't how she framed it necessarily, but it kind of observing it, it seemed like a contrast in that she essentially was saying, you know, gun violence, you know, the violence is the issue, and this is something that it's not just going to be resolved by passing simply one bill. It's going to be something that, you know, the government is going to have to go back and tweak laws and kind of continue to apply to it. And that's something that, you know, you have these really vocal candidates like Beto O'Rourke who are, you know, using expletives to express their frustration with the issue, but, you know, there's really so much more that these candidates can do to kind of get at the issue. And even if you look at polling about support for red flag gun laws and assault weapons bans and things like that, clearly there is this sort of spectrum that these candidates can kind of go into, as opposed to just a full, you know, government seize of guns and, you know, the other end of the spectrum with completely allowing everything and the government completely stepping out of the process.
Yeah. And also remind us sort of how Cory Booker was talking about gun violence. It certainly was distinct from how O'Rourke and some of the other candidates brought it up.
Yeah. And Cory Booker really has a good habit of drawing on his experience as mayor of Newark, New Jersey. And he really kind of brought out the city component of it as mayor and how he observed the issues there. And I believe that he talked about, you know, homicides and issues like that, and kind of this day-to-day issue of gun violence, that it's not always, you know, these mass shootings where, you know, you're dealing with weapons of war necessarily, but kind of a day-to-day process and a day-to-day issue that is still very much concerning and very much affects these communities that are affected by it.
Right. And so lots of candidates on the stage last night, but actually in October, the debate, it's going to look a little bit different. Lauren, can you remind us, so some did not qualify for the debate last night, but will be on the stage in October. Who are those candidates?
Right. So the Democratic National Committee has some funky qualifications where this most recent debate only allowed 10 candidates, but the polling qualifications and get the requirements to get on this next debate stage in October are different. So there will be more than the 10 candidates that were on this most recent stage. Those candidates that people saw last night are expected to be on the stage come October. We're also expecting Tom Steyer. He's a billionaire who runs all those advertisements that people see on TV. He's expected to make the stage. Look, Marianne Williamson, who says that she's about there, having qualified. Tulsi Gabbard is another candidate who is expected to qualify. She needs one more poll. She needs to meet that polling threshold, but she says that she's met the fundraising threshold. So at least now we don't officially know, but it looks like there could be at least 13 people on stage, whether that's multiple nights of debates. We don't really know yet. Those details are still not yet out. But as of now, Tom Steyer, Marianne Williamson, and Tulsi Gabbard are looking like they could be on the next debate stage.
Okay. And we've certainly been hearing from them here in New Hampshire, and we'll talk about that in a minute. Thanks, Lauren, so much. I'm sure we'll be talking to you as the campaign rolls along.
Thank you for having me.
So, Josh and Carol, we got a sneak peek of this debate in Manchester last weekend, as you were saying, Josh, at the New Hampshire Democratic Convention in Manchester.
19 candidates there.
Yes, 19, in fact. So, and one of my questions for you all is just, was the dynamic of kind of an alignment with Biden and the Biden-Obama legacy that we saw last night, people being quite laudatory of Biden, kind of aligning themselves with him last night. Was that already happening last weekend at the convention?
Well, I mean, certainly the vice president has worked hard to make sure that people remember that he was vice president to President Obama. You know, at the convention, so that's a slightly different audience and a different atmosphere. This is a crowd of, you know, sort of committed Democratic activists, delegates to the party and or paid staffers of campaigns. So, you know, they're fired up to hear, you know, hot talk from the candidates. And you certainly had, you know, Elizabeth Warren probably made the strongest show of force at this convention. I mean, she had lots of supporters there. They brought in trash bags full of so-called thunder sticks, sort of look like long balloons and make a lot of noise.
Wow.
So, you know, when she hit the stage, I mean, it's a 2-minute ovation before she talks. And, you know, she gave a strong speech. You know, Biden was kind of the Biden we've seen up here, talking about his long tenure, talking about wanting to build on the legacy of President Obama, you know, casting himself as more of a moderate, which is kind of what he is within the spectrum of Democrats running. You know, all the voters you talked to, and you were there, Carol, too, they will all say job one is to defeat President Trump. You know, they might have different ways to skin that cat. I mean, I've talked to some voters saying, like, you know, for years we've got crumbs. I think this year we need to grab the whole loaf and really, you know, elect a nominee like, you know, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, somebody who's promising real systemic change. Other voters I talked to said that they had concerns about what one guy told me, who's a Klobuchar supporter, was the in his words, democratic socialist agenda of free college, free health care. And he thought that that would, you know, potentially put the party in a tough position against President Trump. You know, it's important to remember we are still 5 months from any real action in terms of casting ballots or the caucuses in Iowa. And so there are a lot of people, even committed people, who are sort of, you know, could be into any one of them at this point. Yeah. And it's worth remembering that.
I think I was going to, I didn't raise my hand, but I will chime in.
Go ahead.
Yeah. I think it's interesting also because, as you mentioned, you know, 4 years ago, Bernie Sanders was sort of like the, you know, the guy with the crazy ideas, the left, you know, left field ideas. And it seems a lot of his ideas are now really catching on with the entire party platform. The last guy standing, Andrew Yang, who, you know, myself and three other people, no, I'm just kidding, but it was a light crowd. But he said, you know, Donald Trump got it right when he said, you know, we need to make America great again. He had the right point and that he knew what the problem was, but he had all the wrong answers. He's turning back the clock. He's building a wall. He's reverting to a, you know, a time in history when we all thought everything was, you know, gee willikers, 1950s and all
and,
that.
And this was Andrew Yang kind of at the end of the convention.
At the end of the convention, yeah. What he said was, we need to look forward. We need solutions for the future as we see the fourth industrial revolution coming and all these jobs, call center jobs and supermarket jobs are going to go away too.
Yeah.
And so how are we going to fill that gap?
Well, the Yang Gang, as they are called, yeah. They were very loud in the hall at the debate last night.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, when you all have been out reporting, what is the reception that he's been getting? I mean, the press coverage is that it's a lot of kind of middle-aged dudes. But are his supporters, in fact, more diverse than that?
Well, you know, I haven't actually covered that many Yang events. I mean, I saw plenty of young people wearing baseball caps that said math on them at the convention.
Okay.
And, you know, he has certainly thus far, you know, outstripped expectations. And, you know, I mean, to Carol's point, it is a lot of Democrats want to know the way forward. And that's one thing that, you know, could provide kind of headwinds to former Vice President Biden's campaign, which is largely this notion of like sort of restoration of what was before Donald Trump and building on that. And, you know, plenty of Democrats you talk to say, you know, I may respect Joe Biden, I appreciate what he's done, but like, I don't think we can go back. And that's something that, you know, the party is grappling with. You could see that on stage last night. You could see, I thought that Lauren's comment about Amy Klobuchar was interesting because she's somebody who is a moderate within the current confines of the party, has said, you know, I've been able to get 100 bills passed while Donald Trump is there. Like, I'm from the middle of the country. The country is not necessarily, you know, what's in a Democratic Party convention hall. And, you know, to win, you're going to need someone who can appeal to people who may see things differently. And, you know, that's a question that Democrats are going to have to weigh. You know, that's a question facing Elizabeth Warren. You can see that she's trying to sort of calibrate her message in a way where she says, you know, I've thought through the problems and I've got solutions that we can discuss. Yeah, it's interesting.
It is interesting. We'll have you all back to discuss for many months to come. This is NHPR's weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. When we come back, we'll take a look at Manchester, where leaders are facing tough questions over how to deal with crime, homelessness, and addiction. Stay with us.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-855-855. 887-5430.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Sarah Gibson. We're going to spend some time now looking at homelessness and addiction in Manchester and throughout the state. But first, on Monday, the Attorney General's office made the rare move of taking over all the criminal cases at the Hillsborough County Attorney's Office. The AG said it was necessary because Hillsborough County Attorney Michael Conlin wasn't implementing changes they had recommended soon after he took office this past January. Conlin says he is making progress and will continue in his role as an elected official in spite of the AG's actions. Attorney Conlin is on the phone with us now. Welcome.
Good morning, Sarah. It's great to be here.
So now that the AG has taken control over criminal cases, what's your role at the office?
My role continues as the elected Hillsborough County Attorney. There are a lot of issues at this office, I would say both regarding, the administration of the office. I look forward to continuing those efforts to the extent that the Attorney General allows me. I would also be willing to help out in any way possible with the prosecutorial operations of the office. There's a lot of issues across the board here.
So right now, are you just solely in control of civil cases, not criminal cases?
Well, the office doesn't actually handle civil cases the same way that the Attorney General's office does. Our function is largely related to the prosecution of felonies and misdemeanor appeals in the county. But I'm here to do a large component of the rest of the work, which is having strong relationships with other agencies the office works with, the day-to-day functionality of the office, personnel, budget, and other matters.
Okay. And you've said you inherited many of the problems that the AG is concerned about. And they acknowledge this, that some were very longstanding. But they say you had ample time and guidance from them to make changes. Here's Deputy Attorney General Jane Young on Wednesday.
There has to be policies and procedures, communications with police departments, communications with victims. And that comes from one person, the county attorney.
So, Attorney Conlin, what's your response? Have you implemented some of the policies and procedures they recommended?
Well, the first recommendation for any specific policies and procedures came to me at the end of July when I had just finished the four-month process of dealing with our budget, which both as a result of their review from this office last year, was underscored as an incredibly important priority of this office. And when I came here in January, I did my best to insert myself into the day-to-day operations and understand what was going on. And I would say that, the notion that the situation is dire today, it was even more dire in January when I first started here. I took the time to invest in the top priority of the budget that the team also agreed with me was the top priority of the office, to get the resources that haven't been received over the past decade by the county budget process. As I worked with my management team to free them up as best as I could with the resources I had available, and then explore what policy procedures would be a priority based on my discussions with them, since the Attorney General's review in calendar 2018 under prior administration had no specific guidance as to what policies and procedures should be made, nor any prioritization as to areas of focus.
And so there were some procedures that the Attorney General's office wanted implemented. There were also high-profile cases that made the police, the Manchester police, quite unhappy, that regardless of the high caseloads that certainly everyone was struggling with, the AG's office says you should have known about. And they're citing this particular case last month against parents whose toddler died of an overdose in their home. My understanding is that the attorney who was in charge of that case is now suspended. But the police say ultimately the sentences were far too lenient. And I'm curious, what's your response for why weren't you following that case more closely and more knowledgeable of the ultimate resolution of that case?
Well, I handle the exceptions as they arise in cases, since I already have a management team in place, including two senior prosecutors in each office location that I consider to be the first line of defense for supporting the line prosecutors in handling important cases such as that one. And in this, in that particular case, there was a communication breakdown both internally and externally with Manchester Police Department. You know, that incensed me as well. It was a very disappointing way how that case was particularly handled. You know, there are over 3,500 cases this office handled in calendar 2018, and we're on track to approximately meet that at least for this year. So, you know, the notion that I wasn't aware of what was happening in three particular cases when we handle over 3,000, I don't think is unreasonable when I have to have the trust of my team to bring issues to me when they arise, and both the trust of my management team to, you know, handle issues as sort of the first line.
And the attorney on that case did not bring the case to your attention.
That's correct. He made representations to Manchester Police Department that he was going to, but he absolutely did not. And I think that's really unfortunate because that was a really important case, I think, for both the community, the police department, and should have been for my office as well. But due to some communication breakdown, which I acted swiftly in response to, from a personnel matter, that did not happen.
And finally, Attorney Conlin, I'm curious what message you have for residents of Hillsborough County. This is New Hampshire's most populous county. There are many who might be concerned about the ability of your office to administer justice and do its job well, whether it be the fault of many people. At the end of the day, what would you tell them about your office's ability to do its job right now?
We have a lot of dedicated professionals who have given their careers to the to public safety and to the prosecution of crimes in Hillsborough County. Those people are fortunately still with us, and I look forward to working with them to help ensure that they have the support that they need to get their job done. That's what I've been saying since day one, that my job is to make their job easier and do what I can to make sure they get the answers that they need. You know, I welcome, you know, the resources and support of the Attorney General's office, but I think it's unfortunate some of the comments they've made about, you know, my leadership and the performance of this office in general. I think that does nothing to advance the needs of this office, to address the issues, and to ensure that the public, you know, has confidence in the ability for crimes to be dealt with appropriately and that justice to be delivered. That's what I'm going to be focusing on, and that's what I think we should all be focusing on.
That's Hillsborough County Attorney Michael Conlin. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Now turning to other news in Manchester this week, homelessness, addiction, and how it's playing out in city politics. Carol Robidoux, the editor and publisher and founder of the Manchester Inklink, is with us in the studio. Carol, there's been a lot of news in the past month or so about growing numbers of homeless people in Manchester. Why this increase?
Well, that is $1 million question on some level, or it could be a $48.5 million question. I'm not sure. But what we're seeing since January, and this is something that Mayor Joyce Craig has tried to point out, looking back at some documents that have gone back and forth with the governor, this isn't something that just came up the other day. She's been trying to get across to Concord that since the doorway program, which started as Hub and Spoke, but when the doorway opened in January as our new statewide delivery system, something seemed to happen, which the doorways, there's nine of them, and majority of them are working in some fashion, but they don't have the it's I think Fire Chief Goonan called them the doorways to nowhere. Basically, you walk in and you need help, and they're sending people to Manchester, and we have documentation of that as well. So we're getting an influx of people that weren't coming here a year ago because they were whatever they were doing for services. Now that they're being directed in a certain way, the resources don't exist to only here in Manchester really do we have the support, the beds, the recovery options. So that's one big piece of it, I think, is the shifting of how people are supposed to get what they need.
Mm-hmm. And we'll talk about that a little bit more with a few more guests. But I've also heard there is certainly the closure of the Nashua shelter and just a dearth of emergency shelters throughout New Hampshire. Earlier this week, NHPR had the director of New Horizons on who spoke to this a little bit about, you know, just the amount of people who maybe would have sought shelter elsewhere who no longer can. Is that one of the reasons as well?
Yeah, I think right now they're on target to hit 1,300 unduplicated people in the shelter, which is up last year, 2018, they saw about 1,000. So the demand on the shelter, the lack of earlier this year when I was there in the spring, they had a system where they had these very thin foam mattresses stacked up. And at the end of the day, they just spread them out in the dining hall to accommodate. They just don't have the beds. I think they have 70 some beds that they're supposed to be. That's the limit. But they've been housing upwards, I think, an average of 140 a night in the summer, some nights up to 165.
So simply on foam mattresses that are on the dining room floor.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what are leaders, city leaders, proposing about what to do about this issue?
Well, they have to approach it from a few different ways, because one of the problems that they've realized is that the hub system is supposed to be a catchment zone. So Manchester has a fairly wide catchment. There's a lot of cities and towns surrounding that are supposed to come to Manchester. But there's a lot of people coming here from outside of that. And
For addiction treatment
services. Right. So the idea is to figure out a way in something that Chief Goon called Safe Station 8.0, where you would return people to their hub if they came here for help.
So Manchester would pay for transportation for someone
to return to
Littleton?
Well, that's a question. I think the transportation issue is something that they need to work out as far as how that looks, who would do that transportation.
Yeah.
And, you know, the doorway here, which is Granite Pathways, has limited hours. And according to Chief Goonan, the majority of people coming to the Manchester doorway are delivered there by Safe Station.
Right, right.
So yeah. It's
And there's also so in addition to the doorway, which again we'll discuss a little bit later on, because there's so much to say about that regional system for addiction treatment and resources. But there's also ordinances that are being proposed by city leaders with the kind of idea that people should not be camping in the parks. It's very connected to this desire to, you know, have downtown be a place where people can play and go out to eat and to reduce some crime. But there's these ordinance proposals. Do they have much hope to actually address the problem in a deep way? And do they have support from city leadership?
Yeah, that's another good one, because they've wrestled with and discussed ordinances and how effective they are, what's in place now, how are they being enforced for months. And one of the bigger issues was the legality of telling people you can't sleep here, you got to move along, you can't lie down in front of this business and you know, fall asleep during dinner hour, you know, and it's public space. So I think one thing that they were looking at or waiting for was this decision out of Rochester,
right,
which affected can you camp in a public space?
This was a lawsuit, right?
This was a lawsuit. And I think according to our city solicitor, Emily Rice, the court said that the city can has some ability to enforce that.
So they can issue tickets to someone who's, say, sleeping in a public space. Can they remove that person?
That's the other tricky part. And this is something that Police Chief Carlo Capano has talked about, is we're moving people around. We're sort of shuffling them from here to there. We're telling them you can't be here, so go there. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, the bigger issue is getting people out of this limbo, out of this state of homelessness, and not getting the services that they need. The shelter has very limited resources when it comes to outreach, and so they can only do so much. They divide their resources between here and Concord. Mm-hmm. So there might be one or two days a week that there's one person doing some outreach on the streets, but ultimately there has to be a a bigger solution all the way around.
Yeah. And so many of these questions are popping up in the mayoral race, as you know, that Republican and former state rep Victoria Sullivan is campaigning against incumbent Democrat Joyce Craig, pledging to reduce crime, to reduce homelessness in her city. Do you think this message is resonating with voters?
I guess I would say I don't see any meat on those bones yet. She's saying a lot of things that sound just like everything you always hear during a campaign, but I haven't seen her issue a proposal of any sort. She talks about getting more police officers on the street. Well, that's something that the city has been trying to do for at least the past year, and they've gotten the go-ahead and the funding to add more officers full-time. But Chief Carlo Capano just said the last entrance exam that they had in August, it was dismal turnout. They had very few officers come and way fewer than that get past the first or second hurdles.
Right. Police recruitment is a challenge throughout New Hampshire and particularly in Manchester.
Right. So I would love to see from Victoria some actual proposals that go above and beyond what is all there. A lot of the things she's saying are already actually in motion and happening. And it's more like these sweeping generalities that you hear at a debate or something rather than here's my plan. Here's the meat on the bones. And I think that's what people need. Otherwise, it just really becomes a political fight like it always does.
Yeah. And we'll continue following these really important questions. Coming up, we'll get an update on how Manchester and the state are tackling the opioid crisis in the courts and in the state's regional addiction system, which you've been talking about, Carol, the doorway system. And don't forget, you can join us by email exchange at nhpr.org or on Facebook or on Twitter. I'm Sarah Gibson, and we'll be right back.
Become an NHPR sustainer today for a chance to win a trip to Nova Scotia, Canada. If you're our lucky winner, you and a friend will take a ferry ride from Bar Harbor, Maine to Yarmouth, Nova Scotia for a relaxing five-night stay, where you can cruise the Acadian shores, explore the city's rich maritime history, or eat fresh oysters to your heart's content. You'll be automatically entered to win this incredible trip to Nova Scotia when you support the news you trust at nhpr.org.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Sarah Gibson. Joining us now are Carol Robidoux, editor and publisher of the Manchester Inklink, Jason Moon, NHPR health reporter, and Tim Rourke from the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation, which funds addiction prevention efforts. So, Jason, let's start with you. You've been following lawsuits that New Hampshire is involved in to hold pharmaceutical companies accountable for their role in the opioid crisis, which just earlier this hour we've been discussing has a tremendous effect on cities and towns throughout New Hampshire. Can you catch us up on the news this week from Purdue Pharma?
Yes. So the news right now is that there is a proposed tentative settlement on the table proposed by Purdue Pharma. And they are looking for a sort of global settlement to resolve the more than 2,000 cases against them from cities, towns, counties, and states. But what's interesting is that some plaintiffs, some cities, towns, and states seem to be on board with this tentative settlement, and other states, including New Hampshire, are not on board with it. And there are a couple of things at play here. One is that most of the cities, towns, and counties have their cases consolidated into this one massive federal case in the federal court in Cleveland, Ohio, that is set to go to trial next month. And that has created a real that's the time crunch. Though Purdue wants to settle before this thing starts in trial in October, and it's to their benefit to do that. The states like New Hampshire, who have filed their suits in state court, are not going to go to trial until later. And so there's some concern that if there is You know, one thing that might happen is that if there's a big ruling in that big federal case in Ohio, or if there's a settlement for just that case, that the states with later court dates, there may not be anything left to sue, or there may not be any resources of Purdue Pharma left to distribute. So,
in the terms of the settlement, I mean, how much money are we talking?
Well, it's been reported that it's between $10 and $12 billion. It would also involve the Sackler family giving up control of the Purdue company, and it would sort of transform Purdue Pharma into this trust that would sell off assets and use the money for opioid treatment.
So but, essentially wouldn't be turning a profit on selling opioids anymore.
That's correct.
Okay.
But it's not enough for some states, including New Hampshire.
Yeah, and you spoke yesterday to Senior Assistant Attorney General James Boffetti. Here's what you heard from him.
We don't think that this is nearly enough money to compensate for all of the harm that they caused, all of this crisis that's resulted in countless deaths and suffering. And we want to continue to fight to basically reveal what this company has done, to shut down that company and make them pay what they owe to our communities.
So, Jason, what kind of money does New Hampshire say would be enough?
Well, they're not. They don't put a dollar amount in the complaint that they filed in the state court case. But I think one of the sticking points is about not about just the total dollar amount, but the amount that comes from the Sackler family themselves, because this is a privately owned company. It's not, you know, publicly traded on Wall Street. This is controlled by the Sackler family, and the allegations that, you know, the New Hampshire Attorney General's office has made and many other states, including, you know, Connecticut and Vermont, who have also are not on board with this agreement, is that the Sackler family got rich off of selling opioids to people across the country. It, more of the money should come out of their personal pocketbook rather than from, you know, Purdue Pharma itself as a company or some of the other pharmaceutical companies that they owe. So that's one of the sticking points is, you know, what proportion, or is there more money that will come from the Purdue's themselves? The other thing that Boffetti was taking issue with in the proposed settlement was the way Purdue Pharma would sort of survive as this trust. It would be run by a board of trustees, not the Sacklers anymore, but it's his opinion and other states' opinions that the Purdue Pharma should be totally should be totally erased. It should no longer exist at the end of this process.
And one last question for you, just in terms of measuring and quantifying the cost, that seems like a really tricky formula. Like what has this crisis cost, say, a city like Manchester or the state of New Hampshire? Yeah. What's that formula like?
Well, it's really complicated. In different states, different plaintiffs have come up with different ways of looking at it. But basically what states are looking for is abatement. They're looking for not just the cost of the damages of the opioid crisis, but what it would cost to fix it. And so what some states have done is compiled estimates of 10-year, 20-year, 30-year plans to address the opioid crisis. How much would that cost? Okay, that's how much we want from Purdue Pharma, from the Sacklers. And so it is a very, inexact science. It's based on things like Medicaid, costs, overdose rates per capita, overdose deaths per capita in different parts of the country. But basically what plaintiffs are looking for is the cost of fixing the crisis.
Yeah. And Carol and Tim, I would love your thoughts on what you hear from people, either families or health practitioners or people who are kind of on the front lines, when they think about the costs and say 20 years out, what the costs might be. I certainly hear in the education world, we're going to have really different needs in schools for decades to come because of this. What kind of costs, kind of hidden costs that we're not thinking about yet, might New Hampshire see in the years to come?
Sure. So, you know, there has been some economic analysis that puts the total cost currently at an annualized basis in the state of New Hampshire of addiction of $2 billion a year.
That's addiction to all substances?
Yes, but more than half of that is opioid related. And it's important to understand that many individuals who develop an opioid use disorder are using other drugs as well. So I think we need to look at the impact as a whole. Again, to Jason's point, though, that's annualized cost currently. I think you know, in lost worker productivity. It's not necessarily what are we having to invest in building up a new treatment system. You know, that number at a national level is quoted somewhere around $600 billion annually to the United States.
$600 billion annually?
Annually.
Okay, and remind us what the settlement, the potential settlement would be.
Between 10 and 12, I believe, billion.
Right, right. So we're talking, and again, that's not necessarily what we pay for services. That's the cost to society. So I think there is still some work to do looking at how to develop those systems. And to your point, this is a long-term impacting issue. You know, I hear similar in terms of we're looking at issues of children who've been traumatized in opioid-exposed homes, children who've been born exposed to either opioids or other drugs that require more complex medical care, either near-term or long-term. So I do think that there are a lot of conversations around how much is enough, and that's certainly an effort to maximize both to the extent there is a settlement or this litigation proceeds, not only holding the company accountable, but seeking a portion of the family's private wealth is, again, a part of that desire to maximize any settlement resources that could be made available.
Yeah, I wanted to add to that, too. You know, from a reporting standpoint, this is obviously a statewide crisis that has yet to be solved. And I hear these dollar figures, and I know how much money already has come into New Hampshire. And I'm saying to myself, professionally and personally, the money is one thing, and we have money. But where is the money right now going? How is that money being used? Where is the plan for making a difference, a dent in all of this? I don't see a plan. I mean, if the Merrimack River breached in Manchester and the entire city was flooded again, there would be sandbags, there would be a process, there would be a protocol for how to stop the flooding, how to fix it immediately. Who's the resources? Where are they coming from? Somebody would get out the blueprint from the dusty shelf and people would follow it. I'm not seeing a plan. The doorway doesn't have built into it the necessary resources. And this is why there's so many people saying we're drowning here. I just wanted to mention that in an effort to try to get at some of this, in the last year, I'm a founding member of the Granite State News Collaborative, which is an organization of over a dozen news outlets, the Berlin and Daily Sun, the Laconia Daily Sun, the Nash Telegraph, Business New Hampshire Magazine, the Marlin Fitzwater Center, New Hampshire Bar News, Seacoast Media. We are all working together to try to figure out more about, like, go deeper with following the money, with figuring out what the real problems are, who the players are, how they're connected, why things are the way they are. Unfortunately, that's where we're at as a state. We got all this money, but a lot of it's being they're hanging it on the medically assisted treatment model, which is pharmaceutically driven. So here we go again. Are we going to have a new generation of people who are addicted to pharmaceuticals or unable to get off because there's no real plan?
Right. And certainly there's, I think in this field, there's a debate about how to balance MAT, which does work, medically assisted treatment, which does work for some people, with the reality is that it's the most abused substance in prisons right now, when it is used sometimes. So there certainly is that balance. But to your point, to Carol's point, Tim, about following the money, can you just kind of back us up a little bit and remind us how much money has come to New Hampshire recently that is meant to address the opioid crisis, and who's in charge of that money and how's it getting doled out?
Sure. So the Department of Health and Human Services received something called the State Opioid Response Grant. This was a piece of legislation passed by Congress several years ago, and it did two important things. It provided increased funding to every state in the United States to address the opioid epidemic. But the second thing it did is it changed how the federal government releases dollars, so that rather than releasing dollars based on population size, states are receiving funding apportioned to their per capita death rate. What that meant is that the state of New Hampshire received $46 million, 23 a year over the course of 2 years. To put that in context, that's more than the state of Florida received. The state's plan was developed to replicate something called the hub and spoke, which is a model of operationalizing addiction services that was started in Vermont with very good outcomes. It's being replicated here in a slightly different way, which I won't get into due to time. But the essence is it has been an attempt to solve what has been an identified problem. And just to be clear, I serve on the State Commission on Addiction. We actually have a state plan that was just released earlier this year, an offshoot of the one that was released prior to that. However, that funding, there are two challenges, I think, with that funding as we think about it. The first is that what the state has been pleading for, and our congressional delegates, the governor, and even again, I think some of this is one of the reasons why this litigation strategy is so critical, is flexible resources. It's very hard to receive funding from the state or the federal government that does not come with strings attached. So to have a plan is one thing, but to have federal and other funding sources with the ability and flexibility to allow states to do what they need to do has proven to be a challenge.
So what kind of strings are attached to this money that we just recently got?
Well, so the data reporting requirements are relatively onerous. Appreciate the desire for quality, but it makes it really difficult to provide care on the ground. It's time bound. That grant will end. We're entering the second year. There's legislation that's been put forward by Senator Shaheen called the Turn the Tide Act. One of the things it would do would be extend that funding resource and make some additional funding available. But that's currently not.
So we're essentially nearing the halfway point of this grant process.
Correct. The second thing is that the hub and spoke model, I want to talk about the hubs or the doorways, because I think that's the thing that people talk about the most. The doorways, much like a safe station, are designed to address one critical problem in the behavioral health system, which is the moment where someone says, I need help, I'm ready, I don't know what to do next. So the goal of the doorways is not to have 9 centers providing a comprehensive array of services you can get immediately. The goal of the doorways was to create, and even safe stations, was to create these elegant opportunities for people to walk in cold to a building and know this is where I can go to ask for help, and then have qualified people there who can help you navigate to getting to the help you need, which leads to the other challenge. We have done a lot of good work to increase treatment access in New Hampshire. Over the last 5 years, we've seen a 5-fold increase in people actually receiving addiction services. But it is still not enough. Just because we have doorways where people can go in to get care, to get referrals, to get assessment, doesn't mean that those services are available in your hometown.
So can we play this out? Say someone goes into the Laconia doorway.
Sure.
And I use Laconia as an example because when you look at the numbers of people coming from outside of Manchester, far outside of Manchester for services, yep. Many are coming from places that have these doorways. So
yes.
For instance, Nashua, Concord, Laconia. So someone goes in there. It is they get assessed. All that paperwork you're talking
yep.
about gets filled out, which can be onerous. And they stay long enough to fill out the paperwork. And then it turns out that the services they really need, say a treatment bed, is only in Manchester. So
correct.
Then what happens next?
Then they're sent to Manchester. And that's where I think even the current conversation that's happening right now in the city of Manchester with the state and around the state, even some of the doorways are saying, we're doing well getting people in, coming and asking for help, coming saying I'm ready for care. However, that doesn't mean the care is available in our region. So we have, if you need high intensity addiction treatment services and you are underinsured or uninsured in particular, your options are very limited and they're in the southern part of the state. So people will end up migrating to Manchester, Nashua, Keene, which has Phoenix House, if they have private insurance or have some more resources, one of the private residential treatment providers. In the North Country, there's one residential program, but there are regions of the state, Lakes Region, and the Seacoast in particular, where those kind of services don't exist. And I think that's where the conversation needs to continue. These doorways are an important step in the process. The safe stations has been this elegant, brilliant solution to address that part of the process. But we still have work to do to make sure that when that clinician, that expert, sits down with a patient and says, here's your level of care that you require, we're able to give patients options, and that at least one of them is within the region where they live. Many people want to leave their region in order to find recovery, and we never want to discourage people from that. But people should be able to find care closer to home if that is their choice.
Right. And I've met people from Manchester who said I needed to get out of Manchester in order to really get the treatment I wanted, be in a different setting, be far away from friends with whom I had been using for years. And, you know, one of those people ended up in Laconia and he seemed to be doing quite well there. So there is potentially a way that the doorways can be sharing resources and alerting people about resources that are either spot Do either of you, Carol or Tim, do you see the doorways sharing resources, communicating well amongst each other?
They do. And full disclosure, the Charitable Foundation is funding a technical assistance collaborative, bringing those doorways together on a regular basis. But I think it's also important to recognize those dollars came in last year. The first doorway opened their doors in January. They haven't operated very long. And for some of the institutions that are serving in that role, it's a pretty new function to serve. So I think they are sharing information, but they're also very much in learning mode. How do we do this? We have an entirely new population of people who were trying to get into care, and they're learning as they go. And I think that's part of the challenge here, is that it is not as if there is a vaccine in a box that we can suddenly pull out and say we've been able to cure addiction among, you know, thousands of Granite Staters. We're building a system, and that takes time. And unfortunately, many of us, myself included, feel a greater urgency than sometimes those kind of development processes can take.
I think it was also difficult when there was a meeting a couple weeks ago and the mayor of Manchester went up to Concord. You know, the governor basically said, you know, sorry to hear you don't have a plan in Manchester. You know, we'll see what we can do, kind of thing. And the problem is what happened in Manchester was a result of this statewide delivery system. It had nothing to do with Manchester's plan or not plan. We have the homeless shelter and the soup kitchen that is the largest one in the state.
Right, as Tim is saying, people are actually actively sending.
We can only do so much. We can only put so many mats on the floor before it's, you know, danger zone. So yeah. it's
so complicated. So Carol, I'm curious, in the next couple of weeks, what are you be watching for as you continue to report on this?
Yeah, so we have a new homeless coordinator who's starting on Monday, and he has an interesting history. So we'll see what that does to help kind of get at all of this. I mean, the whole addiction and opioid crisis is a puzzle we have yet to untangle and solve. So we have lots more work to do. I could come back every day next week and we still wouldn't know what the answer is.
Well, thanks so much to all of our guests, Carol Robidoux, Jason Moon, and Tim Rourke. As you said, there's so much more to discuss and we'll try to get you all back here soon. That's it for today. If you want to see the video of the show, we'll be posting that on Facebook shortly. You can hear our podcast, find that and so much more at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Michael Brinley is our program manager. Theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm Sarah Gibson. Thanks so much for listening.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.